From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as armed men force the UN Special Envoy to flee Crimea, John Kerry meets with his Russian counterpart in search of a diplomatic solution to the Ukrainian crisis.
It's a tinderbox and it's waiting for a spark to set off a much wider conflagration. We have to hope it doesn't happen, but the best way to stop that is certainly to get a lot more international presence on the ground.
Plus, the internal CIA investigation into whether the agency illegally spied on the computers of US lawmakers. And we have the details in a major medical breakthrough in the fight against AIDS.
These were studies done in monkeys, and monkeys don't always tell the truth, but they're an important step in the process of developing this new potential prevention method.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. A United Nations Special Envoy investigating the situation in Crimea has been threatened by unidentified armed men and forced to leave the peninsula. Robert Serry was visiting a Ukrainian Navy commander when his car was blocked by an armed group chanting slogans in favour of Russian President Vladimir Putin. FSN's Tom Barton is on special assignment in the Crimean capital, Simferopol.
They told him that they had an order to take him to the airport. He refused to go with them and walked to a coffee shop where he stayed with an ITN reporter as the armed men waited outside. He eventually left the coffee shop, entered a vehicle and drove away to the airport. These men were from the so-called self-defense battalions that are now patrolling all over the Crimean Peninsula and putting pressure on Ukrainian garrisons to try and make them surrender.
The special envoy's departure from Crimea came as US Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov were meeting for their first face-to-face talks since Russia's attempts to take control of the peninsula. Mr. Kerry spoke after the talks broke up in Paris.
We agreed to continue intense discussions in the coming days with Russia, with Ukrainians, in order to see how we can help normalize the situation, stabilize it, and overcome the crisis.
NATO is trying to keep the pressure on the Russians after a two-day meeting of the NATO Council in Brussels. Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says there will be no meetings of Russian and NATO staff, except on an ambassadorial level, and that every agreement between the two sides will be reassessed by next month.
We have put the entire range of NATO-Russia cooperation under review. NATO foreign ministers will take decisions on this in early April.
From Moscow, a warning. The Russian parliament began debating a bill that would allow the Kremlin to confiscate the assets of Western companies in response to any economic sanctions imposed by the US and its allies. From FSN's Moscow bureau, Daria Bondarchuk.
The head of the parliament's constitutional legislation committee said it is studying whether the proposed measures would be constitutional. But he stressed that sanctions should be mutual and assured that such a move from Russia would correspond to European standards. The rumors of upcoming sanctions have already sent Russian market indexes plummeting on Monday, with local currency hitting a historic bottom. The country's central bank had to intervene and spent some $11 billion to support the Russian ruble.
In other news, the United Nations says one-third of Syria's chemical weapons have been removed from the country or destroyed. The mission has been hampered by setbacks, but the UN says it's still on target for the final deadline for the complete destruction of the stockpiles. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Now, with more on the news that progress is being made with regard to Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons, FSN's Nick Harper reports from our bureau at the United Nations in New York.
According to the head of the UN mission to rid Syria of chemical weapons, Sigrid Karg, the last few days have seen acceleration and intensification of efforts by the Syrian government. But Ms. Karg said this month was essential to the overall success of the mission.
We look forward to see continued progress, but it remains hard work, and the month of March is the critical month.
The schedule has slipped following bad weather, security issues, and claims of the Syrian government dragging its feet. The plan is now to remove all the weapons by the middle to end of April and complete their destruction by the end of June.
Britain may need to implement a sugar tax to try and lower rates of obesity, according to England's chief medical officer. The food sector in the UK says it's trying to reduce sugar content in many products, but as FSN's Natalie Feary reports from our London bureau, the government is poised to take a tough stance.
Most adults and children in the UK eat more sugar than is recommended as part of a healthy diet. And England's chief medical officer warned that with evidence of sugar being addictive, the public needs to be made more aware of its harmful effects. A sugar tax on soft drinks could raise close to the equivalent of $2 billion a year for the UK government. But the Food and Drink Federation said this would hit poor families hardest, adding that sugar content is already listed in a product's ingredients.
The main news again, a United Nations special envoy investigating the situation in Crimea has been threatened by unidentified armed men and forced to leave the peninsula. Stay with FSN for continuing coverage of the crisis in Ukraine, here and on Twitter. You can follow us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The UN's Special Representative Robert Seri has ended his mission in Crimea after a group of armed men hijacked his car and took him hostage in a coffee shop. Reports said some of the militia involved were wearing combat fatigues and the Black and Gold Star of Russia. This, as John Kerry described the actions of Moscow as unacceptable and uniting international opinion against Russia's military manoeuvres in Ukraine. The US Secretary of State met with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Paris, the first time top officials from the two nations have met since the Ukraine crisis escalated. The US repeated its call on Moscow to pull back its forces and negotiate directly with the interim Ukraine government. As tensions continued in Crimea, hundreds of pro-Russian demonstrators stormed a government building in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk. Our correspondent Tom Barton is covering events in Crimea and spoke to me earlier.
Robert Seri of the UN was in the regional capital Simferopol. He was coming from a meeting that he'd had with the Navy HQ here. When he left the building, there was a gang of armed men, he said some of them carrying guns, outside that building that stopped him and said that they had orders to take him to the airport. He refused to go with them and made his way to a cafe where there was an ITM reporter who stayed with him. He asked him to stay with him as these armed men blockaded them inside, standing outside the door, some of them wearing the orange and black armbands that signify support for Russia in the Crimea. He eventually decided that he had to get out, left that, and then had quite a fraught experience making his way to a car, which they then attempted to blockade, but eventually, with police help, he managed to get away to the airport. And Mr. Seri said he was happy to leave Crimea if it helped to defuse that situation.
A very tense situation by all accounts, Tom. What can you tell us about events where you are now?
Well, I am now stood near the Ukraine Hotel, which is pretty much the main hotel in town, where a number of OSCE observers, due to try and sample, to try and look at the conditions here in the Crimean Peninsula, arrived, only to have themselves blockaded inside the hotel by a large group of quite burly individuals. There's probably about 70 of them now surrounding the gates to that hotel. They're not allowing people in or out. They're enforcing their own kind of document checks on that. There are a handful of police, about 10 policemen, vastly outnumbered by the protesters, trying to keep things calm. The atmosphere, though, is very tense indeed. You can see some of the guests nervously looking out of the windows of the hotel, wondering if and when they're going to be able to get out of the hotel. And again, a lot of these orange and black armbands signifying support for Russia. So rather a tense situation here as well. Who knows? Some of these men could have been the very same that made problems for Mr. Seri earlier in the day.
Those armed men that you refer to in the background where you are, Tom, that Sergei Lavrov would call a self-defence force, are widely referred to as pro-Russian, if not Russian, troops. Is that right?
Well, these men, these crowds that I'm observing now, are not in military uniform. They're in their own, if they have any combat gear, it's probably their own from home. And they're a sort of a so-called self-defence organization, militia that's gathered. But there are also these unmarked men in very advanced and professional military garb around various points, usually around military bases, around the Crimean Peninsula. And they, those individuals are indeed the ones that the Russians deny are anything to do with them or that they have any control over, which gained, quite frankly, just derision when it was announced in front of Western diplomats. John Kerry was one of those who burst out laughing when the Russians tried to convince him that that these were not Russian troops. And we've seen drips of evidence that these are, in fact, Russian soldiers. A name badge photoed on the back of one of their uniforms today saying they came from a Russian city, and another name badge seen by a BBC reporter saying that that particular individual was from a Russian paratroop regiment. So really, I think it's pretty much only the Russian government left that is hanging on to some kind of pretense that they do not have thousands of their own troops tightening their grip over the Crimean territory.
What is their role and what have they done since arriving en masse in Crimea in terms of taking control of the region?
Yes, after arriving, after either leaving their bases or arriving into the territory, they have proceeded to surround Ukrainian military bases, of which there are quite a few, probably around 10 of different types across the region, surrounded them and then proceeded, often with the help of these more informal self-defense battalions, to put immense pressure on those inside. We're hearing reports that, as well as just surrounding and patrolling them and keeping up their presence, there's also reports that they have fired warning shots. Well, not reports, that was an actual incident, that warning shots were fired recently over the heads of Ukrainian troops trying to march to work at Belbek Air Base, which is near the large naval port city of Sevastopol. We've also heard reports that the families of these of officers and soldiers inside these Ukrainian bases have started to be threatened if they're not surrendering.
Tom Barton in Crimea. Now, as pro-Russian demonstrations flare up outside of Crimea, Vladimir Putin's broader military ambitions in Ukraine are now the subject of intense scrutiny and debate. Earlier, I spoke to Matthew Rajansky, an expert in US and Russia relations, with the Wilson Center think tank in Washington. He began by explaining why the treatment of UN Special Envoy Robert Seri in Crimea was an indication of just how unstable the situation has become.
Yeah, my sense is that what happened to the UN representative being essentially accosted by armed men while trying to do his job, which is maintain some semblance of transparency and communication between the Russian and Ukrainian forces, is just emblematic of the major risk factor in the region today, which is not that there'll be a wider Russian invasion of Ukraine. We obviously couldn't know for sure what Putin's intentions were when the troops first moved into Crimea, but it seems clear now that they're not likely to mount a broader operation. But what is very possible is that with so many armed men on such hair trigger alert, and so many different factions here, right? The Russians are in some ways disavowing that troops that are obviously Russian, in fact, are under their command. They're claiming they're reporting to local authorities that these are somehow volunteers. But at the same time, on the Ukrainian side, you have soldiers who are in uniform and in bases and armed, others who are out of uniform, who can't get into their bases because they were blocked out by these so-called volunteer self-defense forces. And then you have plenty of non-official armed groups altogether floating around Ukraine, because let's not forget, you can't separate the events around Crimea from the triggering episode, which was the violent fall of the Yanukovych regime, which entailed armories being overrun and police stations around the country, lots of weapons floating around out there, lots of angry people with various different interests. So my assessment of the situation right now, and this would apply as much to Donetsk and Kharkiv in the east of the country as to Crimea, is that it's a tinderbox and it's waiting for a spark to set off a much wider conflagration. We have to hope it doesn't happen, but the best way to stop that is certainly to get a lot more international presence on the ground so that you have credibility and transparency, and then, of course, to get a political process and a geopolitical process going to negotiate a compromise.
But in order to prevent that spark from happening, that spark that would trigger a wider expansion of Russian force in Ukraine, there needs to be a deterrent. And at the moment, is the deterrent being offered in the form of, say, economic penalties from the US and the EU strong enough to deter Vladimir Putin from this course?
Well, I don't think that we're going to change the situation by bludgeoning the Russians. It's clear that on a physical military dimension, Western forces, NATO is not going in. That would just add more unpredictability and chaos and likely violence. On the economic sanctions front and the diplomatic isolation front, I mean, some steps are already being taken, and I think they're beginning to pinch ever so slightly and really remind the Russians that there are longer-term consequences here. But again, my biggest concern is not at this point with Putin's intention. I think in a way he's shown his hand, and his hand is to punish Ukraine by excising Crimea, which had always been in many ways closer to Russia than to Ukraine, but to formalize that, to make Crimea one of these extraterritorial enclaves as exist in other parts of the former Soviet Union.
Matthew Rudzianski, expert in US and Russia relations with the Wilson Center think tank in Washington. This is FSN Reports. The CIA's Inspector General is currently investigating whether the agency illegally spied on the computers of US lawmakers and their staff when they were crafting a report on the government's use of torture during the George W. Bush administration. Senators, CIA officials, investigative journalists, and the White House continue to argue over what aspects of the torture report, if any, should be made public. Some say it would be a national security risk to release it, while others say it would merely be embarrassing and would lead to accountability for violations of international law. On Capitol Hill, our correspondent Alice Olstein reports.
The Senate Intelligence Committee spent more than 3 years and $40 million investigating the use of torture by the CIA under President George W. Bush, which they concluded was both ineffective and violated human rights. But the public still can't see their 6,000-page-plus report, as both the CIA and Justice Department have fought to keep it classified. Now, citing unnamed government officials, the news organization McClatchy says the CIA required the committee to use their databases at a secure facility in Virginia to conduct the investigation, but monitored them while they did so. Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein confirmed to FSN that the Inspector General of the CIA is currently looking into these allegations. But like most of her colleagues, she refused to answer questions about what the CIA is accused of.
I have no comment.
My answer is classic. It's a first, and you're going to get the scoop. No comment.
I'm not going to comment on that story in the media. I usually don't comment on matters revolving the committee simply because of the sensitivity of it.
Intelligence Committee member and Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, a longtime critic of government surveillance, would also not speak to the specific allegations, but said the Obama administration has made it a huge challenge for Congress to conduct vigorous oversight of its actions.
There's no question that there are very real threats to our country. What is at issue is I and others, and you see it in our bipartisan bill with respect to the Patriot Act, feel that the government has pursued a variety of measures that don't make us any safer and threaten our liberties, number one. And number two, there is a deeply embedded culture of misinformation among the intelligence leadership. We're not talking about the rank and file. We're talking about the intelligence leadership.
Wyden's Democratic colleague Mark Udall wrote to President Obama this week asking him to strip the CIA of its power to decide what parts of the torture report, if any, be released to the public. Wyden voiced support for this effort and said he's been frustrated that his attempts to work with the Obama administration to redact any sensitive information has been so far unsuccessful.
I think it is possible to make the key sections of that report available without compromising national security.
Some civil liberties groups and investigative reporters are currently suing the executive branch under the Freedom of Information Act for access to both the summary of the Senate's torture report and a secret internal CIA document that members of Congress have said supports their finding that torture did not help the CIA gather intelligence. Attorney Shane Cotterdall with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents survivors of torture at Guantanamo and overseas, said the public deserves to know the truth about the effectiveness of torture.
Unfortunately, the American public, having, you know, spent thousands of hours, you know, viewing shows like 24, kind of operates with the assumption that somehow torture may work and that it, you know, it's just that it's distasteful and may have some blowback in terms of foreign policy in the Muslim world. But the underlying premise is always, it works, right? And if it ever comes out that after years of doing this in the CIA detention programs, that in fact it didn't work, and that it may even have been, you know, utterly counterproductive, that they got less information out than they might have by using traditional techniques that didn't violate fundamental human rights, that blows the cover off the whole program, right? And once you get past the idea that somehow we are a little bit safer by having done this in the short run, then it opens up people's minds to the idea that, well, maybe the people who violated the law doing this, since they didn't make us any safer, and since they did generate all that blowback and all that kind of hostility throughout the world that you know can demonstrably be shown to have made us less safe, well, then maybe they ought to be prosecuted after all for violating the law.
No one who carried out acts of torture in the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, which used waterboarding and stress positions on detainees, has been charged. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, it's been 1 year since Venezuelans bid farewell to President Hugo Chavez, a leader who divided national and global opinion. Today, the South American nation is once again in the grip of political uncertainty as thousands of people take to the streets protesting for change. So far, violent demonstrations, which began early last month, have left 18 people dead. To discuss the situation, our FSN Español correspondent spoke with political analyst Miguel Valade in Venezuela.
This crisis, especially the economic crisis, began last year. The inflation rate was the highest in the world. The shortage of the basic products was also very, very high. The country was beginning to erupt in a very difficult process of change. At the end of last year, on December the 8th, there was the elections for the municipalities here. And this is why, in the last years, all the stress of the people was concentrated on these electoral processes. But this year, without elections and with a very deep crisis, the people looked for a different way of expressing their concerns and their problems. And beginning this year on February, a couple of new emerging leaders of the opposition, one of them Leopoldo López, that is in jail right now, and the other one, Maria Corina Machado, they called to protest in the streets of Venezuela. After this call from these two leaders, the students and different civil sectors of Venezuela began to protest in the streets.
What is the current atmosphere in the streets of Venezuela right now? Are there people still protesting?
Yes. Actually, today, that is a very important date in Venezuela because we are commemorating 1 year since ex-President Chavez died. There are presidents of other countries visiting Venezuela. And today, Caracas and many other cities in Venezuela woke up with protests in the streets, with what they call here, what we call in Spanish barricadas, that are streets blocked by the neighbors and the people. And most of Venezuela is paralyzed today. We are not living normal days since almost a month ago, and we can expect that the protests are not going to end.
What has been the result so far of these protests? Has the government agreed to a dialogue?
In the last 3 weeks, the opposition achieved many, many objectives with this new process of protest in the streets. One of them is that they proved in the world that the regime in Venezuela is not as democratic as they said they were, that there are many sectors of the country that are demanding change. They began to call for a dialogue with the opposition and especially with the students that are right now the leaders of the protests in Venezuela.
Political analyst Miguel Valade in Venezuela. Now, just one injection of an antiretroviral drug has successfully protected lab monkeys from HIV for several weeks, according to the results of new US research. Two separate studies found the monkeys were shielded from the simian equivalent of HIV following monthly doses. Hailed as a breakthrough in AIDS prevention, the drug is now being lined up for human clinical trials later this year. To discuss the research, I spoke to Mitchell Warren, Executive Director of AVAC, an organisation lobbying for AIDS prevention and treatment.
Well, I'd say this is a promising step in a relatively new direction. So over the last decade or so, there has been a lot of work in an area that is now described as pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. And it's the concept of using an antiretroviral, the kind of drug we give to people who are infected to treat HIV, that can actually potentially prevent infection, much like we think about with malaria prophylaxis. And the first drug like this to be studied is tenofovir, an antiretroviral that's very widely used. And it's actually been approved for using PrEP as an oral pill in the United States, and there are other studies around the world looking at tenofovir alone or in combination with other drugs. It's been very powerful protection in the clinical trials, but we do see that adherence matters, and it's true in any drug. Drugs work if you take them, and we've seen in the oral PrEP studies that there is a high level of efficacy. They work well if you take them, but we also see that a lot of people don't take the pill every day. So there's been a lot of talk about how to do better in the future. And one potential option is the idea of an injectable prevention antiretroviral, what's often called long-acting injectables. And there are at least two different antiretrovirals that are being considered. And these would be injections that ideally a person might get once every month or once every 3 months, not unlike the hormonal contraceptive injectable that many women around the world get for contraception. So it's an important concept, and the studies presented yesterday relate to early research with animals, which is always a step before we think about what might happen in humans in AIDS research.
Mitchell, you spoke earlier about adherence being an Achilles heel for AIDS prevention and treatment. Is there any particular demographic or continent where adherence is more of an issue and that a long-term injectable treatment like the one at the heart of this research would make a significant difference to the fight against AIDS?
You know, it's a great question. And I think when we think about adherence, it may have less to do with geography and more to do with the individual at risk. And what I mean by that, when you look at the oral PrEP studies that were done, which took place in 8 countries around the world, enrolling 20,000 men and women, in all the different studies, it was very clear, whether it was in the United States or in Latin America or in Africa or Asia, that you have to use it to get protection. But when you start looking at the data in more detail, there are a couple of things that jump out. Younger people, men and women, all over the world, the younger individuals in the trial tended to have lower adherence than older individuals. In addition, the trial that had the highest level of effectiveness for the participants was actually a trial that enrolled not just individuals at risk of HIV, but enrolled what we call serodiscordant couples. So it was couples where they knew that their stable partner, whether boyfriend, girlfriend, or spouse, was HIV infected and not yet on antiretroviral treatment, and they had very high levels of adherence. So it may be not so much which geographies have higher or lower adherence, but finding populations.
Mitchell Warren, Executive Director of AVAC. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the show via email reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. And join us on Thursday for our usual coverage of US and international stories and features. That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Kate Fisher and Simon Marks on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.